Well, thank you for that great introduction, Alan. I appreciate that. And thank you also to Bill McClay for making space in this program and for the invitation also to speak on poetry and culture this afternoon. So I'll try to keep you awake if I can. Don't make any promises, but we'll see how it goes. All right, so this year marks the 30th anniversary of Dana Gioia's book, Can Poetry Matter? The book appeared a year after the article by the same name appeared in the Atlantic. If you don't know Dana Gioia, he was the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts under George W. Bush, and for many years was the Poet Laureate of California until he just recently stepped down from that position. In this book, Can Poetry Matter?, Dana caused quite a stir. He observed that poetry was no longer part of intellectual life in America. It was not published in national newspapers or magazines. It was not memorized in schools. It was not discussed at dinner parties or bars, and it never appeared in the national discourse. Instead, poetry had become the specialized occupation of a relatively small and isolated group that made almost no impact on the culture at large. Now, I know that sounds like a U.S. senator, but I can assure you that he was writing about poets, not government officials. The audience for poetry has always been small. But what made the arts seemingly irrelevant so odd in 1991 was that it happened at a moment of unprecedented expansion for the art. In the 90s, thousands upon thousands of poems were being published in these small literary magazines that absolutely no one was reading. There were only three graduate programs in creative writing in 1950, but by 1990, there were nearly 200. A proliferation of literary journals and presses followed, Gioia argued, not because people couldn't get enough poetry, but because writing teachers desperately needed professional validation. Poetry was written simply to be published, not read, and publication had become a currency that one could exchange for a job teaching creative writing. The result, Gioia wrote, was that the integrity of the art had been betrayed. Anthologies abandoned selectiveness. They became, he said, something like a directory of creative writing teachers. They were so inclusive. New volumes of verse almost always received positive reviews when they were reviewed in the first place, since an honest review might undermine the credibility of the professional poetry establishment. So it came as no surprise when a well-read critic like Joseph Epstein declared in 1988 that poetry in America was dead. The sheer mass of mediocrity, Gioia wrote, frightened away most readers. Meanwhile, poets of genuine accomplishment struggled to attract attention from the culture at large. So Gioia, he concluded his essay with six modest proposals for poetry to reconnect with the general reader in the United States and again become at least part of American public culture. So I'm going to quote them briefly for you. So the first one was that when poets give public readings, they should spend part of every program reciting other people's work. Two, when arts administrators plan public readings, they should mix poetry with the other arts, especially music. Number three, poets need to write prose about poetry more often and more candidly. Number four, poets who compile anthologies should be honest in including only poems they genuinely admire. And five, poetry teachers should spend less time on analysis and more on performance so they can do what Alan just did and recite a verse from memory up front. And then six, poets and arts administrators should use radio to expand the arts audience. So what's the situation today? Have any of Gioia's proposals been attempted? And if so, what effect have they had on poetry's standing? Are we still awash in mediocre verse? Is poetry any more present in American public life than it was 30 years ago? In short, does poetry matter now? Well, when Gioia published Can Poetry Matter?, there were a few national magazines that published poetry. But the poems tended to be either the kind of elliptical verse favored in many MFA programs, and if you've had the chance, I guess, to read some of these terrible poems. They are usually composed of a series of fragments. They were sprinkled with like references to Daffy Duck, you know, or Walter Benjamin and so forth. They would publish these poems or sort of straightforwardly political poems. Just tell us what to think, you know, who to be upset with, usually Republican president, and move on. There might be a few sentimental, you know, ditties by Billy Collins, you know, on sex or death, you know, just to keep you on your toes. But otherwise, it was just standard fare. There were some exceptions to this, like the Hudson Review and the New Criterion, but these merely proved the rule. Things have improved marginally since, I would say. So First Things, where I'm the poetry editor, has published original poetry in its pages from the beginning in 1990. In 2001, National Review decided to start publishing a poem in each issue, again, something that it used to do in the early days of the magazine, but had gotten out of the habit of doing. There's the excellent monthly publication, 32 Poems, that was started right here in Texas, launched in 2003. Christian Wyman, perhaps you're familiar with him. He was the editor at Poetry from 2003 to 2013, and he published poems of exceptional quality during his tenure there. Things have only gone downhill since, unfortunately. Poetry magazine, they had never missed an issue, by the way, since their founding in 1912. World War I, they did not miss an issue. World War II, they did not miss an issue. But the new editors there decided to skip an issue in September of 2020 to support Black Lives Matters. And they've become increasingly political, unfortunately, since Wyman has left. There's the Contemporary Poetry Review, which was a source of witty and honest criticism from its founding in 1998 until it closed in 2015. The Association of Literary Scholars and Critics and Writers launched Literary Matters, an online publication in 2016, which contains a healthy selection of excellent verse in each issue. Ryan Wilson is the editor there. He does a wonderful job. In terms of national publications with mass circulation, the New York Times and the Washington Post now regularly review new volumes of poetry, but those reviews tend to be pro forma rather than serious attempts to engage and evaluate a poet's accomplishment. The only regular poetry column, at least until recently, I think it just stopped, was Elizabeth Lund's unflinchingly sunny a column that she did for the Washington Post. She would recommend indiscriminately what she called the best books of poetry each month, and strangely, they always happened to be the ones publishers were hyping at the time. There are critics like William Logan, Adam Kirsch, who've come into their own over the past 30 years, and there are a handful of younger poet critics like Jason Guriel, the Canadian, and Anthony Madrid, who lives here in Texas, who give some hope for the future, but elegant and honest criticism is still difficult to find. The return of poetry to the radio, however, and the rise of the internet have marked the biggest shift in poetry's fortunes, or maybe misfortunes, since Joya's article. In 1993, Garrison Keillor, remember him? A short program called Writer's Almanac, which he still does on his own, brought poetry back to the airwaves. WYNC broadcast Poetry Now, which featured contemporary poets reading and discussing their work from 2015 to 2019. The former Poet Laureate of the United States, Tracy K. Smith, who's a wonderful poet, started a poetry podcast in 2018 called The Slowdown. She reads a poem every day. And then there's PBS's Poetry in America, which was first broadcast in 2020 and features guests reading and discussing modern and contemporary poems. And the number of podcasts now that feature poetry in some way are too numerous to count. But it's been social media, however, that's had the biggest impact on poetry's visibility. A survey by the National Endowment for the Arts published in 2018 found that the percentage of adults who reported reading poetry nearly doubled in 5 years from 2012 to 2017. So in 2012, 6.7% of adults reported reading at least some poetry. In 2017, 11.7% did. This was actually the first increase in reading poetry that the NEA had ever recorded in their survey. But the biggest gains were among young people, ages 18 to 24. A whopping 17.5%, so almost 20% of young people reported reading poetry in 2017. This is compared to 8.2%. So again, double in 2012. Now, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts has a wonderful program called Poetry Out Loud, which helps teachers bring poetry into the classroom in an engaging way. They also sponsor an annual poetry reading competition, so focusing on performance, it's excellent. And this has likely helped introduce young people to poetry, but it's primarily social media that has driven these increases. And it's a medium that's particularly suited for sharing poetry. So there's one poet, her name is Rupi Kaur, K-A-U-R. She started sharing her poetry on Instagram as a teenager and published her first book of poetry in 2015 at the age of 22. It sold over 2 million copies. She currently has 4.5 million followers on Instagram. And I'll just read two of her poems for you to give you a little taste. One of her more popular poems is called Not Your Hobby. This is addressed at a love interest, apparently. She writes, "You cannot walk in and out of me like a revolving door. I have too many miracles happening inside me to be your convenient option." That's the whole poem. There's another one called Woman of Color. "Our backs tell stories. No books have the spine to carry." You can ignore the mixed metaphors, but if you've read or heard these two poems, and now you have, you've read or heard all of Rupi Kaur's work, right? Her two modes are writing about teenage romance with a seriousness that would make Taylor Swift blush, or making the popular political statement. There are other insta-poets, as they're called, perhaps you've read about them, that have followings that have proven very lucrative. There's this one anonymous poet called Atticus who prints his or her poetry on wine bottles, t-shirts, hats, jewelry. You can buy an Atticus black crew neck for $65 with the phrase, "She was just my kind of crazy" on it. Or you can buy a t-shirt, $35 bucks. "I'll love you, but just this twice." So these aren't poems, obviously. They are they're marketing copy to move product. But they're very popular with young people. So it's an interesting phenomenon. Amanda Gorman, she rose to fame, perhaps you remember, after she read her work at Joe Biden's inauguration. She's not an Insta poet, but her work is similar in some ways in that it is written to capitalize on ready-made feelings. Take her poem Fury and Faith, which appears in her first full-length book, Call Us What We Carry. It was published at the end of last year. And in one stanza, she writes, "Black lives matter. No matter what, black lives are worth living, worth defending, worth every struggle. We owe it to the fallen to fight, but we owe it to ourselves to never stay kneeling when the day calls us to stand." Now, I actually appreciate Gorman's rejection of perpetual victimhood in those final two lines of this stanza, but the poem is otherwise a string of slogans that rely on the reader's experience of the mediated world of Twitter and Instagram. This is perhaps why her poems work so well on Super Bowl halftime shows and in advertisements. She has signed a deal, I think, worth $17 million to be spokesman for various companies. She only takes deals that speak to her, she says, and so I think a lot of things would speak to me, too, for $17 million. But her poems are generally like this. They don't tell a story. They don't create a scene with concrete imagery. They're not discursive. They are pure immediacy. They recycle ready-made language and rely on performative gimmicks to give them an air of originality. So where are we today, 30 years after Joya's Can Poetry Matter? Well, it turns out we are still awash in mediocre verse. The only difference is people seem to be reading it now. Put another way, the problem is that visibility is no longer an issue, but the integrity of poetry remains. Poets still write flat, fragmented verse to demonstrate they've learned the rules of the game and can now teach others those rules. Joya rightly observed that this is poetry as a means to an end, poetry as a means of getting that tenure-track job. The ready-made and sloganeering work of the insta-poets is also poetry as a means to end, though obviously a slightly more lucrative end, for some of them at least. Political poems always run the risk of becoming propaganda, but the political language of Gorman's poetry lacks the earnestness of even the worst kind of political poem. She doesn't hope to change minds, but to profit from minds that are already changed. At the same time, not to paint too bleak a picture, we have actually seen, I hesitate to call it Renaissance, but a great number of gifted poets writing poems of exceptional beauty. When I started putting this anthology together on Christian poetry in America, which I was hesitant about, to be frank, Christian poetry, or the phrase Christian poetry, conjures up all sorts of, sort of pastel colors and, sentimentality and so forth, which is not the case at all. But as I worked through it, I was just struck, and this is just Christian poetry, but struck by the number of gifted poets and just the beauty of many of these poems. We excluded many poets from that volume. But then go outside of that in secular works, and there's just a great number of young and mid and end of career poets working today. Dana obviously is one of them. I don't have time to list them all, but just to give you a quick, A.M. Jooster, David Middleton, Amit Majmudar, Christian Wyman, obviously, Travis K. Smith, Marilyn Nelson, my co-panelist here, Ben Myers, wonderful poet, James Matthew Wilson, Ernest Hilbert, David Yezzie, Ryan Wilson, Sally Thomas, and on and on and on. So many wonderful poets that are gifted, writing excellent works. We shouldn't forget Clive James, who was international poet and critic of some renown, and Les Murray, who was, quite frankly, a Nobel Prize contender, I think almost every year for a number of years there, until he died in 2019. But those two poets aside, these other poets are sort of, unfortunately, they don't receive much attention. They only receive sort of marginal support from folks on the right and are mostly ignored by folks on the left. Their poems are not published in the New Yorker, Paris Review, and so forth, even though they're much better than what's published in those publications. So we have a situation where conservatives tend to value poetry and literature generally, but primarily for its character formation. And what I want to say this afternoon is that this is to espouse a view of poetry that is certainly more noble than the MFA poets and the Insta poets, but not different in kind. To value poetry primarily for how it teaches us to be humble and kind, for how it teaches us to be good friends and good citizens, for how it teaches us to act justly or to love well, is also to view poetry as a means to an end. To value poetry primarily for what it says rather than how it says it is actually also to undermine its integrity. This leads sooner or later to the subjugation of poetry to either politics or theology, which in turn renders poetry useless in society as poetry. So poetry is an essential part of society, but not merely as a vehicle for something else, but only as itself. So I'm not a Michael Oakeshott scholar, but I find his essay, The Voice of Poetry in the Conversation of Mankind, helpful here. So this maybe gets a little bit technical, but I'm gonna try and keep it, easy to understand if I can. So Oakeshott argues, if you haven't read that essay, that the intellectual life of a society is best understood as a conversation. In fact, for him, civilization is a conversation. It's a conversation rather than a shared inquiry or debate among inquirers about ourselves and the world we inhabit. The problem for Oakeshott with understanding public discourse as an inquiry is that it acknowledged only one voice. This is the voice of argumentative discourse, language of practical activity, which Oakeshott mostly associates with politics. But there are two other voices. There's many voices, actually, but two other most common voices in society, and these are science and poetry. Now, Oakeshott argues that these voices have properties that are distinct from the language of practical activity. One characteristic of a healthy society is the real presence of all three in conversation with each other. And this is what he writes. This is my second and last long quotation. This is what he writes. As civilized human beings, we are the inheritors neither of an inquiry about ourselves and the world, nor of an accumulating body of information, but of a conversation, begun in the primeval forests and extended and made more articulate in the course of centuries. It is a conversation that goes on both in public and within each of ourselves. Of course, there is argument and inquiry and information, but where they are profitable, they are to be recognized as passages in this conversation. The idea is not the whole point of the conversation, but one voice in the conversation. And perhaps they are not the most captivating of the passages. It is the ability to participate in this conversation and not the ability to reason cogently or to make discoveries about the world or to contrive a better world which distinguishes the human being from the animal and the civilized man from the barbarian. Oakeshott argues that defining society in terms of one voice is a kind of barbarism because of its violence and bad taste. It demands that other voices either keep silent or speak only in the tenor of the single voice. At a time like ours that values the practical voice above all others, science, for example, may be allowed to speak, but only if it offers solutions to practical problems. And it often does speak in that voice in society. But as any scientist will tell you, the point of science is not practical solutions, usually. Poetry may speak too, but only if it advocates revolution or right living, as the case may be. This leads to a discourse that is dogmatic and dull, rather than one that is, and this is Oakeshott's definition, an unrehearsed intellectual adventure. That's his definition of society, I suppose. Each voice, Oakeshott writes, is prone to an exclusive concern with its own utterance, which may result in its identifying the conversation with itself and its speaking as if it were speaking only to itself. Education, he goes on, which used to be understood, and in some cases still is, as an induction into the conversation that is civilization, now understands itself primarily as a problem-solving and a knowledge-acquiring enterprise. That is, it trains students to use in the use of a single voice. And an increasingly monopolized discourse, Oakeshott writes, will not only make it difficult for another voice to be heard, but it will also make it seem proper that it should not be heard. So for Oakeshott, regaining the voice of poetry as poetry, not as the voice of practical concern or moral formation, is a step towards regaining civilization. So what are the characteristics of the voice of poetry? I'm going to present Oakeshott's his definitions here. I've got some quibbles with it, but I'll add those at the end. So first, his definition. He argues that the poetic voice is distinguished by the beauty of its language and images, which produces a contemplative delight. So poetry is language that's beautiful and presents images, concrete, that produces this contemplative delight. For Oakeshott, poetic language is not mimetic, and he says it begins and ends as language. So how does poetry as contemplative delight that begins and ends as language contribute to the great conversation? Again, some argue, Oakeshott writes, that poetry contributes by providing rest from useful tasks after which speakers can return with renewed vigor to practical problems. This is in some ways how Aristotle views the arts. Others argue that poetry performs a variety of useful tasks itself, such as disseminating moral values or helping us to see things as they really are. But both of these accounts of poetry's contribution are misguided, Oakeshott argues, since both admit poetry to the conversation on terms established by the practical voice alone. Poetry needs to be admitted on equal terms. So what are those terms for Oakeshott? So he says the terms are this, that poetry is, and it's going to sound weird, but poetry is an escape from the other two discourses. But this isn't an escape that is in the service of those discourses. It's an escape for the sake of escape alone. So Oakeshott says that the voice of poetry is valuable for its difference. He argues that the voice of practical language is actually also an escape. It's an escape or a break from poetry and from science. And that the voice of science is also an escape from the voice of practical language and poetry. He says to refer to escapism with a note of deprecation merely advertises an imperfect understanding of the conversation. Okay. So, like Aristotle, Oakeshott sort of views balance as an inherent good. The conversation of mankind is good to the degree that each voice speaks in its own idiom, in the right proportion, at the right time, regardless of the direction of the conversation, to some degree. He espouses pretty close to art for art's sake view of poetry, and he would likely agree with W.H. Auden's famous line in the poem In Memory of W.B. Yeats, that poetry makes nothing happen. So that's sort of his theory. So the problem with Oakeshott's theory of voices, in my view, and again, I'm not a scholar, so I'm sure you can correct me afterwards if I'm just totally off base here, is that that his definition of each of these voices is overly strict. According to Oakeshott, the practical voice is only concerned with solving problems. For him, all utterances in this idiom are directed exclusively at this, problem solving. But that's not true, right? One can write a book or an essay that focuses primarily on a practical matter, but that also seeks to please. Science may be marked primarily by uninhibited curiosity about the world, but it may also seek to solve problems at the same time. Poetry may be concerned primarily with creating images that delight us with their economy and elegance, but the moral significance of those images is not negligible. Oakeshott himself seems to admit as much when he writes that some of the things said about how poetry contributes to our moral education, quote, may not be ill-observed or untrue, end quote. The fact is that poetry is mimetic. It does help us to see things as they really are, especially immaterial things like love and justice, by representing them in images. But poetry's value is not found exclusively or even primarily, perhaps, in this mimesis. What Oakeshott gets right is that if poetry is admitted to the conversation of mankind only to the degree that it contributes to moral education, that it offers solutions to practical problems defined by practical voices in this idea of moral education, right? Then that's a violence against poetry. It's to admit poetry merely as a means to an end. And if poetry is to regain its integrity in American intellectual life, we must not take only what it says seriously, but how it says it seriously. The form of poetry is valuable in its own right. It is inherently pleasing. But it also has some secondary benefits, the form of poetry, that we miss, I think, when we focus exclusively on morality in poetry. The form of poetry shows us that an ordered life is a beautiful life. Robert Penn Warren, he argues in Democracy in Poetry that poetry as poetry can be a model of a rightly organized self. Christopher Lash believed that one might learn any number of things or any number of virtues from literature, courage, self-discipline, charity. And so does Warren. He thinks you can learn those things But Warren argues that the form of poetry expresses something even more profound. This is what he says in Democracy and Poetry. The form of a work represents an adventure in selfhood. It embodies the experience of a self vis-a-vis the world, not merely as a subject matter, but as translated into the experience of form. Style is not only pleasing in itself, which it is, but it also teaches us a great number of things. Again, it's not primarily to teach us these things, but it has this as a secondary benefit. Teaches, for example, that it's actually good to entertain. It's good to be a good conversationalist. Focusing exclusively on the moral content of poetry may teach us to be good, but it might also teach us to be bores, you know? Style of poetry helps us to develop an appreciation for restraint, develops an appreciation for wit, for the value of understatement, for not saying everything that comes into your mind, right? For the pleasure of finding just the right word, for the beauty of harmony and variation. Style in poetry teaches us that a life preoccupied exclusively with practical concerns is not a beautiful life. Now, again, we have a good number of poets working today whose poems, I would say, are beautiful poems and great, wonderful poems. But again, these are rarely published in our most prestigious publications, and they go largely unread or only treated in passing in publications on the right as something that's added to the overwhelming political content of those publications. Not that there's anything wrong with political content in publications, but... So what can be done in this situation? So I want to just second very briefly what Michael Pack said last night, that conservatives are great at funding political organizations and publications, that they aren't so great at funding the arts. But we need literary publications that will praise talent and mock incompetence. We need national publications that are willing to do that. We need publications committed to honest and beautiful prose. We need national book prizes that are not in bed with the identity theorists. We need publishers capable of designing and marketing books that match the elegance of the words contained in them. Some of this is already happening. In fact, a good deal of it is already happening, but there's much more to be done. Thank you very much.